from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Carrie Perloff is stepping down as artistic director of ACT after directing the company for a quarter of a century. She came to ACT in 1992 and shortly after raised $31 million to rebuild the Geary Theater. At ACT, she developed a long partnership with playwright Tom Stoppard, staging many of his plays, and for her final show, she returns to another playwright whose work she's often directed, Harold Pinter. The birthday party opened last week, and I'll talk with Carrie Perloff about her career, the future of theater in San Francisco, and the new production, all coming up next. Stay with us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. ACT Artistic Director Carrie Perloff is stepping down after directing the company for a quarter century. For her final show as head of the theater, she's returning to a playwright she's worked with and studied closely and a play that she staged two times before, Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party. It's running through February 4th at ACT. And welcome, Carrie Perloff.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, you're not really retiring. You're going to be writing books and you're going to be writing plays and doing all kinds of things. You can't keep your spirit down, I know. But quarter of a century is a big marker. It's mine coming up in February, too.
I know. Bravo.
Well, I don't know. It may be time for me to consider it. Step me down. That would make some
we'll trade
happy.
Jobs, Michael. You can come run a theater and I'll try radio.
No, I'll take away absolutely decline in running a theater because, you know, it's amazing what you've done in the course of these 25 years. I was just looking back. And, well, first of all, 50 stages, main stage productions, starting another theater, The Strand, picking up from the earthquake and so forth. It's a legacy, and it's a remarkable legacy, and I just want to congratulate you on that. It's also a kind of beautiful chaos, as was the title of your memoir, which we discussed. But there's a sense that you've come away learning some serious lessons in all this. I want to just start on the serious note, because you talked about you realize gender, how important it's been in terms of your role.
Gender?
Yeah, being a woman.
Yeah, well, it's very fascinating being a woman at my age now following this Me Too movement because so many of the belittlings and slights and humiliations that we all went through as women, we just sort of thought were personal. And it didn't. Certainly when I came to ACT, when I look back and see the way I was written about when I came, the kind of really patronizing pat on the head, what is this little girl going to do tone of some of the press, you know, I just sort of thought, well, that's how it goes. And when I now look back and read it, I think, wow, it is true that the assumption is often that a woman just doesn't know what she's doing. So I do think we've moved forward on that front. And, you know, there's been great joy in leading an institution as a woman. I only know what it's like to lead something as a woman because that's my only experience. But I do know that, for example, I've tried very hard to make ACT a place where children are welcome and where seasons don't go by, where there's not serious female presence on stage, backstage, and at the leadership. So that's been, you know, a big passion of mine and something I fought hard for.
No, you've done a lot. You had a whole education program and training program that you vitalized and you kept the Bill Ball spirit of we never dumb down and all that. But you did say you have one regret, I believe, no acting company.
Well, you know, I believe that actors lead the theater. I mean, I think they are the most ancient part of the theater, and I revere actors. I think it's a kind of shamanistic craft, what actors are able to do. The courage of a great actor should be at the center of the field, and I am not a believer in celebrity. I'm a deep believer in training and craft, and so, you know, I long to work with highly trained and exquisite actors for whom theater is their destination. And of course, that's very naive now. And
well, for one
idealistic.
Thing, the city's become too expensive.
They
for
can't
actors,
afford right? it here or anywhere. Nobody can afford to have a career in the theater. And when you do have a career in the theater, you're not valorized the way you are if you've had a career in television or film. And so that's been a big fight for me to put the American actor at the center of the work. And for a decade, I was able to sustain a small group of actors with a fairly decent salary, 52 weeks a year, actors who were also teachers and visionaries and directors and thinkers and who helped create the seasons. And, you know, so that's a value I hold very dear. I feel with this production of The Birthday Party, this is like, in some ways, my de facto company. These are artists I've worked with many, many times or have trained. And that's why it was such a profound experience for me working
You've
on this.
Also worked with Harold Pinter, may he rest in peace, and Tom Stoppard, and had special relationships with both of them. And so it's appropriate that you can kind of step out of this role by producing The Birthday Party, which is really the play that put Pinter on the map in many respects, along with The Room. It was also a play that almost every critic universally, except perhaps one in England, completely bashed.
Right.
And I've always been of the mindfulness that Pinter just, they didn't understand him. They didn't get him.
Well, what is so astonishing, The Birthday Party is 1958, 59, and he wrote it when he was 28. But it is absolutely, he found his voice the first time out to bat. And that almost never happens. I mean, he had an absolutely unique poetic language that was muscular and sexy and threatening and specific, and he found it immediately. And the great gift for Pinter is that he had the courage of his convictions. Everybody hated it. Not just this play, but, you know, when The Homecoming came to New York, the Broadway producers in their inimitable way said, well, what are you going to, you know, Act Two doesn't work. What are you going to do about Act Two? And he just smiled and said, that's my play. So he had, you could say, the arrogance or the courage to stand by what he'd written, knowing in some way that he should trust it. And, you know, what I have felt coming back to The Birthday Party 30 years later is that it now feels frighteningly real. It's much less abstract than people, I think, thought it was.
Well, one of the things that's always struck me about The Birthday Party, and for that matter, most of Pinter's work, although I think he went into a much more poetic phase later on, with plays like Landscape and so forth, is the language. And in fact, we had Robin Lakoff on just recently and talked to her. I kind of alluded to the fact that there's this whole sense of power in his language and taking control and dominating, and the subtext and how important the subtext is, just the pauses and the way people speak and what's underneath the speech in terms of meaning as opposed to the actual words themselves.
Well, the stakes are incredibly high in Pinter. There's no fat. There's no exposition. There's no wind-up. The characters do not exist until they step onto the set.
Being on stage, Walter Kerr called it.
Absolutely. And so, for example, Goldberg and McCann enter the stage. Two hitmen. You have no idea who they are. One's in a suit. One's in a kind of leather jacket. They say, is this it? This is it. Are you sure? Sure, I'm sure. Then there's a famous Pinter pause, and then McCann says, what now? And it's so terrifying. Now, it's because underneath it all, so much is going on. Goldberg is coming to find his nemesis. McCann is terrified because he doesn't know what the rules of this particular job are. And so he needs to, in some way, hold on to his rage until Goldberg instructs him about what's going to happen next. That language is deceptively simple. There's no language in the play that you wouldn't understand. Is this it? You know, but the way it's structured in Pinter, the rhythm of it and where the silence has come is terrifying and masterful. And so you have to work on it like a piece of music.
I like to explain it sometimes as also so much having to do with tone. You say to someone, what's your name? And they say, what? And what they really mean is, why are you asking me my name?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you say it in a kind of menacing or threatening way, what's your name? And suddenly they answer. You've had a whole power struggle there within about, you know, a few nanoseconds and whatnot. It's always interested me, though, that these two main menacing characters, as they're so often characterized, are a Jewish name and an Irish name.
Well, it's like a great setup for a joke. A Jew and an Irishman walk into a pub, except this is an old seaside, into a room. And what happens? I mean, I don't think that's coincidental at all. It's a very Jewish play. which is one of the first things that really struck me and struck me in working with Pinter in the room together in the studio 30 years ago in New York. You know, he was a poor Jewish guy from the East End of London. He lived through the Blitz. He was evacuated with a lot of children to Cornwall. He hated it. He came back and lived in London during the bombing in a period of huge anti-Semitism, and then became a conscientious objector, which was very negative to the Jewish community, given that Britain had fought Nazism and won the war. So he was always sort of a contrarian. But the Jewish thing, the sense of both your tribe and being part of a tribe, but also the incredible oppression of organized religion and the occasional fascism, in a way, of organized structures of society was something that really preoccupied Pinter. And also the need to resist that is very profound in his plays.
You did this play a number of times, I think twice before mm-hmm. this, and you did it once with the Mountain play together. I mean,
Mountain
another
Language,
Pinter, yeah, Mountain Languages.
Right.
In fact, Frank Rich even commented on that and spoke about the special relationship. How did you get the special relationship with Harold Pinter?
You know, I first studied Pinter with Martin Eslin, who wrote Theater of the Absurd, when I was a sophomore at Stanford. And, you know, you find touchstones in your life of artists who change your universe. And Pinter was that for me, just absolutely changed the way I saw the world. So when I became artistic director of CSC in New York when I was very young, I wanted to do the birthday party. I couldn't get the rights to do it. I kept begging his agent. He hadn't had a production of it in New York since its premiere and didn't like American productions of his plays. He thought they were too confessional and not taught enough or not funny enough. I don't know. And so it took me a very long time. It was Tony Harrison, the British poet, who finally persuaded Harold to give me the rights. And then I was pregnant with my daughter, with Lexi. And Pinter's agent, Judy Daish, a very fierce chain smoker, would ring me every week and go, "Have you had that child yet?" So Lexi was 10 days old when we started rehearsals for the birthday party the first time. And Peter Riegert always liked to say he played Goldberg, that he knew which act we were on by which breaths the baby was on, you know. And she slept through most of it appropriately. And opening night, Pinter couldn't come, and he sent Lauren Bacall, his friend Betty, you know. So I have a picture of Betty Bacall holding this my baby on opening night. And then about 6 months later, his agent rang me and said, "Pinter's written a new play called Mountain Language, and he would like you to do the American premiere, but it's very short." And so we came up with the idea of doing it in rep with the birthday party, and then Harold came to rehearse both of those plays with us.
Was he at all a pain? I mean, you know, it's I know you worked a lot with him, but you hear so frequently about playwrights who get involved in the productions and they become very exacting, very difficult, very contentious even.
First of all, if you're Harold Pinter, you get to be exacting. Do you know what I mean? No, I mean, here's what I thought was so astonishing about him. He started as an actor. David
yes.
Barron was his stage name. And so he understands the acting process absolutely. He never patronizes actors. He completely understands their confusion, their questions, their need to know what the action is. What he doesn't do is fill in motivation. And he says, he writes a lot also in his essays about the impossibility both of verifying the past and of knowing why anyone does what they do, even the people you love the most or yourself. You don't know really what drives you to do what you do, but what you can know is what is the action in the moment that you do it. So he always talked incredibly specifically in terms of action on stage, of what effect somebody was trying to have on somebody else. He gave great notes when asked. He never intervened when not asked. And I have to say, also in light of this whole Me Too moment, I was a very young, unknown female director in my 20s. He never patronized me. He was incredibly respectful to me. I was the director. He waited to be asked if I wanted to know something. And otherwise, you know, he was just a great presence. But he was also a great director in his time. And so I found him just enormously helpful and fun. You know, he was also kind of wicked. Like, he always knows when somebody's hiding something. So we had an actress in the cast called Wendy McKenna, who played Lulu, and he kept saying, "McKenna, McKenna, Irish?" And she'd say, "No." Days later, "McKenna, McKenna, Scottish? No." It turned out she was Wendy Rosenberg. She was a nice Jewish girl who changed her name, and he sort of knew it, you know, and he loved that kind of thing. He loved taking the actors out for drinks and telling war stories.
Speaking about unverifiable and unknowable, do we know why getting a little gossipy here, but why Harold Pinter's son stopped talking to him and changed his name and wouldn't keep the name Pinter?
It's incredibly heartbreaking, and I don't know, except that, you know, it was a very, very fraught relationship. His mother, Vivian Merchant, was a great actress, and she drank herself to death, and that was a, you know, profound loss for Pinter, and I think it never got restitched. I do know that years later, Tom Stoppard was very kind to Daniel Pinter, then Daniel Pinter, and took him in, you know, but it was, you know, his marriage to Antonia Fraser that finally made Pinter, I think, a family man in some way. He was very, very happy with her, but he'd had a really difficult time.
He was also someone who, maybe a little gossipy too, but I have British friends who knew him who used to say that as much as they loved his work and loved him personally, he would always get into politics, and most of it was inveighing against the United States.
Yes, he was virulently anti-Bush and anti-American, anti-American imperialism. He was involved with the Sandinistas. He was outraged at the whole Nicaraguan situation and very vocal right through his Nobel
speech. Even before that, Vietnam.
Oh, Vietnam, outraged, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, here's one thing that is part of his dynamic. This was a man who needed an enemy. That's why he writes the kind of plays he has. And some people are like that. Some people have to define who they are by what they're in opposition to. And he needed that. So when we were in rehearsal, the New York Times was the enemy. And when they sent down their photographer, he tormented her. She asked him to hold the script in a photograph. And he said, I wrote the bloody play. I'm not going to hold the script. You know, he was awful to her and awful to the New York Times. And it sort of made us laugh. I mean, he had an incredibly contentious side and a big temper. It never evinced itself in rehearsal. But certainly when we did Celebration, his new play, right after 9/11, he was supposed to come here to San Francisco to be with us. And 9/11 happened, and we did the play the day after it previewed. And it was one of the most profound experiences I've ever had in the theater, Michael, because I didn't think anyone would come. It was a time of unbelievable national grief, and we were doing these plays about terror. And the theater was packed, and the audience needed to be there. It was so palpable. But he wrote me and said, it would be the utmost hypocrisy for me to come to America at this moment. So I send you my love, but I can't come. And that's the last time I ever saw him.
And since you mentioned Celebration, there's a play by David Story called In Celebration,
yes.
Another British playwright. And I know you have a special fondness for British playwrights as well as absurdist playwrights and so-called anger after playwrights.
I have a big fondness for my British husband. That's
yes, and that may indeed put the seal of Anglophile on you. But there is a whole sense of these great plays that came out of this post-World War II era, Pinter. And Story is another one, Stoppard. I mean, these are playwrights, obviously, who had an immense amount of influence on you. And so did the whole kind of anti-fascist. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, you see The Birthday Party as an anti-fascist play, don't you?
There's a moment at the end of the play where Petey, who is in a sense the most quotidian character in the play, a lower middle class deck chair attendant sitting in his bedsit, when Stanley gets taken away, Petey screams out, Stan! Don't let them tell you what to do. And Pinter said, I've lived that all my life, that line. And he felt that's the only thing you could do as a human being was resist the tyranny of fascism or organized religion or tribalism or organized crime or groupthink. This is why the language is so important, right? He spent his life trying to reanimate language as it got acquired by or taken over by kind of cliched groupthink. And this is way before the internet and sort of the cyber world really denigrated language and to be sort of a meaningless set of 140 characters. But he felt that the only hope for humanity was to somehow keep language true. And he also knew the danger of words as being pablum, or as he said, stratagems to cover nakedness. And if you listen to Goldberg in the play, this is a man who talks about family and faith and love and is the biggest killer in the play.
As all the shibboleths. And Stanley Weber is not necessarily a character that we would want to see as a victim to identify with. He's a bit of a washout, I think, is what Lulu calls him. And indeed, that's the case. A protagonist that's hard to, the way he teases Meg in the open, I'm talking here about a play that a lot of people haven't seen but should see. And indeed, the opportunity is there because it's playing at ACT, and Kerry Perloff is with us this hour, staging her last play after 20 years, 25 years at the helm. Are you optimistic with you and Tony both retiring about where Bay Area Theater is going?
Well, I'm sure there will be fantastic new leadership. And I think that I think change is always a good thing. And I think it will be really exciting. I think it's also an incredibly difficult time in the Bay Area. And so it's going to take real vision and muscle, not only on the part of the leadership, but, you know, if this citizenry wants arts and culture to survive in San Francisco, a lot of changes are going to have to happen.
Such as?
The situation on our streets is shocking and frightening, and it is keeping people from going out at night because people don't feel safe. The income inequality is astonishing. No one can afford to move here. So for artists, to try and keep artists in San Francisco, or indeed to hire people at a nonprofit, is very, very challenging right now, because even if you try to pay as much as you can pay, the housing situation is punishing. So, and at the same time, there aren't new sources of funding. You know, it's my big hope that eventually the tech community will embrace arts and culture as part of its mission, and will exert some generosity in that direction.
It hasn't been moving that way.
It has not been moving that way, but I remain hopeful and optimistic that as these people grow up, it will be important to them and they will care about it.
What feeds your hopefulness and optimism?
I guess I just think, you know, theater is an ancient art form. It is not a new impulse. It has survived onslaughts of every kind, and yet the deep need to transform, the deep need to tell a story, the need to gather and listen and be part of something seems to be bigger than any individual moment. And you know, I think right now we're at a crisis in American culture about what it means to be a citizen, because this is a very libertarian, me first, selfish moment in American history, where collective action doesn't seem to be, or collective anything, taxes. We don't want to pay for anything. We want everything to be free. So, you know, the arts are going to have to keep asserting their collective importance, and hope that it will matter to people who have the wherewithal to support it.
Talking with Kerry Perloff, and we do want to bring you into this conversation. She, of course, for many years has been the director of American Conservatory Theater here in San Francisco, and is the author, by the way, of a book called Beautiful Chaos, A Life in the Theater, and she has had a remarkable life in the theater. And I'd like to hear from listeners about, well, not only what we just touched on, Bay Area arts. Are you optimistic and hopeful the way you've heard Kerry Perloff express her sentiments? And also, you might want to join us, and we're talking about Harold Pinter. We certainly would be interested in hearing thoughts about his career, amazing career, a Nobel Prize recipient. But also, if you want to talk with Kerry Perloff about her work and her career here, which has been outstanding by any measure, or let us know, since she, as I said, has been responsible for 50 plays, that's about two every year, if there's one you particularly loved, or maybe one you particularly despised.
Hated.
Yeah, we'd like to hear that and like to hear why. Duchess of Malfi got a lot of response, probably still people who want to respond and let us know about that production.
Oh, yes.
But we do want to hear from you. Join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Any ACT production that has stayed with you over the years is really what I'm asking, and why. But also, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us with any questions or comments you have by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with ACT Artistic Director Kerry Perloff. She's stepping down after directing the company for a quarter century, and her final show as head of the theater, she's returning to playwright Harold Pinter, whom she worked with and studied closely. It's a play called The Birthday Party, and we do want to hear from you, our listeners, if you have thoughts about particularly plays you've seen or a single play that has stayed with you from an ACT production, good or bad. Please feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number, again, is available. It's 866-733-6786. Or if we have any Pinter enthusiasts or Pinter detractors, I'd be interested to hear from you as well. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And we're taking on the topic, or we've taken it on already, about the future of theater here in the Bay Area and the Bay Area art scene, and particularly in light of how difficult it is to find a place that is affordable for actors or for people involved in the theater. And speaking of actors, well, I want to get to the cast of this play. But before I do that, I got a caller I've got to get on here, and that's Gary, because this is going to, I think, please you. Go ahead, Gary. You're on.
Yes. I moved into the city. My wife and I moved into the city in 88. And we saw the production of Duchess Amalfi. Loved it. But I had come from New York. I see a lot of avant-garde theater. I thought the theater in San Francisco was a little milquetoast. And we had very bad seats, by the way, at the theater. And so many people left. We ended up getting – we moved in some really good seats, and we really enjoyed the show. And I still have the poster on my wall. It's a great, fantastic poster. It's a beautiful poster.
That is a great story. See the unintended consequences of disaster is that somebody gets a good seat.
Yeah, yeah. We ended up like the show was just great. We had no, you know, the people that moved that left were just like, what are they? What's wrong with them? So pedestrian in their taste.
Wow. Well, I got
what you say. Yeah. Since I was in my 30s when I moved into this area, and now we go to the ballet, we go to the opera, we go to the symphony, we go to individual shows, and I don't see a lot of young people picking up the, you know. Picking up the theater bug.
Yeah, are you drawing in any of those millennials or folks from Silicon Valley?
I mean, I don't know that they're the Silicon Valley millennials, but I find a couple of things. I mean, ever since I've been in the theater, and I started in the theater very young, there has been this sort of moaning mantra that the young people are not going to the theater anymore. And, you know, 20-somethings have stressful lives and they're trying to make a living and move out of their parents' homes and get out of debt and everything else. And so maybe they're not going to the theater in record numbers, but people have always started to go when they're older in life and they have more time. I don't think that's a catastrophe. You know, I love every age being at the theater, but I will say I have learned that it's surprising what brings younger people to the theater. And one of the youngest audiences we have ever gotten at ACT was for our recent production of Hamlet. Also one of the biggest African-American audiences we've gotten. So this sort of cliche that young people don't like Shakespeare or they don't like things that are difficult or that has to be obviously relevant and be about tech in order to get an audience, I don't think is true at all. I mean, I think, you know, the challenge is that most people aren't taken to theater in school anymore. There's very little arts education and universities have completely abdicated their responsibility to either, you know, produce art or train people to watch the arts. So most young adults are having to have their gateway experience to arts and culture later in life. And that's much harder. It's intimidating to start going if it's not something that you've done when you were young. And that's something that we can do something about.
And let me thank Gary for the call. Good to hear from you, Gary. Has Lin-Manuel Miranda changed theater? I mean, has Hamilton have
a major impact? Well, I think it's had a wonderful impact. He's an absolute genius, and I don't say it lightly. The language in that musical is astonishing, and I hope it raises the bar for the American musical. You know, it's an outlier, but, you know, brilliant works are.
Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Don from San Francisco. Don, join us.
Good morning. Good morning, Kerry.
Good morning.
I just wanted to tell you how excited I am to be going to see the birthday party. I've only lived in the Bay Area for a couple of years, but my wife and I quickly subscribed to ACT. And I'm excited about the birthday party because I've never seen it. And probably the single most fabulous experience I've had in the theater was a Pinter production of Homecoming on Broadway that just blew me away. And it set a very high bar, and I'm hoping that bar will be achieved by your production. But I'm very excited about it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, the production that Carrie directed of The Homecoming Hero was pretty damn good, too. I didn't see the one on Broadway, but thank you. It's good to hear from you. In fact, we had a little panel after that.
And, we did.
It was with a Pinter scholar who's coming back.
That's right. So Michael did. You all listeners should know that Michael Krasny, among his many talents, is a Pinter scholar and teaches Pinter at State. And I have come and enjoyed teaching his students Pinter.
Except you taught my students Beckett.
We also talked Pinter. But anyway, did Beckett.
Right, yeah.
And Michael and Austin Quigley did a wonderful panel. And on February 3rd, for any of you who are interested, after the matinee free, Austin Quigley, who's one of the great Pinter scholars, is coming to speak to do a post-play discussion with the cast after the show. And I'm fascinated to hear what he'll have to say.
And Bill writes, I subscribed to the very affordable preview series at ACT and saw The Birthday Party Tuesday night. What a funny, beautiful, and provocative production. I thought each character was perfectly acted and directed. And you had quite a cast here, Carrie.
Well, you know, the one great thing about leaving, Michael, is that you can call in all your chits. So I called the actors I sort of adored the most, starting with Marco Baricelli, who was the lead member of my company for a decade and whom I revere. And I asked Marco if he would do this, and he said, yes, absolutely, if Scott Wentworth played Goldberg. Scott, I had just directed at the Stratford Festival in John Gabriel Borkman, and he was here many years ago in Mary Stuart, and he agreed to come. And then I went to Judith Ivey, whom I had directed in New York when I was very young. I always say Judy was my MFA. She is a consummate actress and comedian, and she taught me so much. And I tried for 25 years to get her out here, and she could never make it. So I called and said, this is it. You want to come to ACT? Come now and play Meg. And it was her idea, amazingly, to cast Firdaus Bamji, whom she adored and whom I've worked with many times in Indian Ink and other plays, as Stanley. And it's particularly moving to have an actor of color in that role, just astonishing. And then Dan Hyatt, you know, is really one of the Bay Area all-stars. I mean, a great treasure of the Bay Area, and had just done Polonius for me, is Petey. And then, you know, because one of the most important things about ACT is its MFA program, it was very meaningful to me to cast an MFA, an alum, Julie Adamo, as Lulu. So it is an amazing company. They are like lions. They're like athletes, you know, and every day we'd come to rehearsal, it was like watching them all raise each other's game in the boxing ring. The thing I will remember most about rehearsing this play is usually when actors are not in the middle of doing a scene, they're either on their phones or they're in the green room. And in this rehearsal process, I would turn around and they were watching each other all the time. And I found that very moving.
I see a very moving remark by a listener about you, but I also see one that's critical. Which do you want to hear first?
Oh, I'm so used to criticism. Bring it on.
Well, this is Mike who writes, I was listening to Ms. Perloff with interest until she made that condescending remark about Silicon Valley types maturing, which I take to mean raining money on the arts. Shakespeare did not need a government grant to live on.
That is completely not true. Shakespeare survived off government support. That was the most traumatic thing of his career. If Queen Elizabeth was angry, he didn't get funded. End of discussion.
you want the Valentine now? This is a listener who writes, we've been subscribers since 1995 and we'll miss you terribly. Farewell, Carrie Perloff, wishing you all the best.
Thank you.
That's a lot of
sound. Don't worry, I'm not disappearing into the ether.
Where is the ether?
I don't know.
Here's a caller from Santa Rosa joining us. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, I've been a subscriber since the 80s. Moved to Santa Rosa and I have been a subscriber ever since, and I want to thank you, for one thing, for making it easy to be a subscriber, to change your tickets. That process has been so wonderful and has allowed us from the North Bay to be able to get there, you know, with work and family and all kinds of things. That's been super helpful. We loved Hamlet recently. We thought that that was the best performance of Hamlet. We had the most understandable performance that either one of us had seen. I love the silent sounds, or whatever the name was, at the Strand. That was a terrific performance. And so there's just too many to name. And thank you so much. And being a subscriber allows us to see things we wouldn't normally see, but we still go and see them and see a lot of gems. So thank you so much.
Oh, that's lovely of you.
Thank you.
It's, you know, the reason that the nonprofit theater started this subscription model was that, and I don't know what the future of subscription will be, whether, you know, in this very overtaxed, busy, stressful time, people will continue to make that commitment. But one of the things that is amazing about if you are willing to commit to subscribing to something is that it's the play you least thought you'd ever love or want to see that becomes the thing that's the most meaningful to you. And it happened to be on your subscription. And so you went and you wouldn't have chosen it otherwise. And I think that's a kind of really profound serendipity. I hope it doesn't disappear.
It's always challenging, though, for, I mean, being a head of a theater or, for that matter, a museum, to decide, you know, am I going to go with something that I know will bring in a lot of people, droves of people, Hamlet probably a good example of that, because everybody's had to study Hamlet at one time or another, or just something that's very current and Al-Quran or whatever, as opposed to doing something that you really think the public could appreciate. And I have the same problem curating, you know, programs, too.
You know, ultimately, I think it's really important to assume that your audience has wide-ranging and eclectic appetites, and not to ascribe opinions to them or thoughts, you know, that aren't true. You have to do the things you're most passionate about and make a case for them. It's funny you say that about Hamlet, because in large classic, in large regional theaters, the classics are all but disappearing, and major productions of classical plays. Even at ACT, we used to have much more opportunity to do large-scale classics than we have now, because they're so expensive and fewer people want to see them. They're long. You have to make a commitment to being there. They're linguistically dense. It takes a lot of concentration, and there's no funding for them. The only real foundation funding out there, tragically, is for new work. And so I think that's a real concern. That you know, the foundation upon which we are building our contemporary work is disappearing, and contemporary work is most interesting in relationship to what has come before. So it would just be like going to the ballet, and it's so important at San Francisco Ballet that they do brilliant new work, and it sits next to Balanchine, you know, and if you lost all the Balanchine, you'd lose a lot. So that's a red flag, I think.
I think it was Jim Dunn from the College of Marin who put on a Hamlet with cowboy suits or something like that. I mean, there's always this attempt to try to go into a contemporary vein in some fashion or another. But when you were talking about the patience that it takes now for younger people who communicate by text and by email and so forth, and just everything moves so quickly on television and through the way that news is disseminated, to sit through, say, you know, a play by arguably one of the great American playwrights, Eugene O'Neill, even a play as magnificent as Long Day's Journey Into Night, it's quite a commitment.
It is, but you know, we do a thing in the second year of our MFA program called Will on Wheels. It's an hour-long redacted Shakespeare that we take to schools. You know, they do it in cafeterias under fluorescent light at 8 a.m. And the thing you learn over and over again is what Ezra Pound said. Literature is news that stays news. Great plays are great plays because they're rich and meaty and complex, and they wrestle with all of the issues we're dealing with today. Justice and immigration and gender and integrity and power and betrayal and any big meaty thing you can think of, the great plays take on. There's no reason they can't still resonate, but we have to make them available to people early on in their emotional lives. You are what you read, and you are what you see.
Maybe also what you eat. Carrie Perloff is our guest, and she's the Artistic Director of the American Conservatory Theater, and Mark is our next caller. Mark, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, just two comments. I'm a local actor that's worked at ACT, so one, I want to thank Carrie for maintaining a commitment to casting local actors, especially, you know, what is essentially the biggest game in town. It's impressive that so many local actors get to work there. And secondly, having worked with her, I have to say that not only is she usually, you know, she functions as a director, but she also functions as a dramaturg. In the room, she is always the smartest person and knows the most about the play. It's kind of incredible how much she knows when she's working on a piece. So thank you, Carrie.
Oh, that's sweet.
And good luck.
Thank you.
You're going to reduce her to tears. Thank you, Mark. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from another listener, and that's Tracy. Tracy, you're on.
Hello. My husband and I subscribed to ACT in the early 90s, so I think the first plays we saw, productions, were Angels in America, but my favorite, and thinking about the performance still gives me chills, was A Streetcar Named Desire with Marco Baricelli, and I remember the lights dropping at the end of one act, you know, when you know he's attacking Blanche.
Yes.
It was just so amazing. I really enjoyed your Small Company during the years that was going. So thank you.
And thank
Marco
you for the
will
call.
Be happy to hear that.
I'll ask you a question about Streetcar, because it's a question that's always kind of stayed in the craw of my consciousness. Is a rape necessary? I mean, he's really destroyed her by that point. Does he really need the
Well, rape? I mean, necessary. Look at the
dramatically
world
or any other
we're
way.
Going through. I mean, rape is never necessary, you know. But
no, I mean, for the play, obviously.
Well, yes. I mean, why do men exert their power over women through sexual violence? It's a terrifying question, and Stanley needs to do that. That particular vulnerable neurotic male ego needs to break that woman. And it's terrifying and awful. But it is one of the things that's true in the world. I mean, to go back to the birthday party, Goldberg and Lulu go upstairs after act two and you have no idea what has happened. But she comes down the stairs and lets him have it. And
what's that line of hers? You did things to me that...
You taught me things a girl shouldn't know before she's been married at least three times.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the difference is that Pinter gives Lulu some ammunition. She gives as good as she gets. But that is the hardest scene in the play because she's really been destroyed. And if it were an American play, she would come down and weep and be, you know, confessional about it. And Pinter never allows that to happen because confession is too vulnerable. So you always mask your despair and find a way to fight back. That's how his universe works. Even Stanley, you know.
And our universe works with more callers. Roger, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for this discussion. It is a gorgeous thing, beautiful thing. So anyway, I have a $64,000 question for you guys. Why don't you guys live stream plays and sell tickets to that? So anyway, I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, and it is beginning to happen. It's a very complicated union issue because, you know, theater actors are not paid well, and their performances, they're being paid to do it 8 times a week in front of a live audience. So, you know, if their performance is then being given out free, how do the artists get compensated? And so there are a lot of issues that are being wrestled with about that in order to make that accessible. But I think that is something that's going to happen in the future. And it is already happening. The National Theatre is doing it in London, and you can see wonderful productions from London live streamed. It's starting to happen. I will just say this, though. There, you cannot experience a play by Pinter unless you see it live. I just believe that. It is about bodies in space. The tension in the room is so palpable because you are in the room with them. Do you know? And there have been films of Pinter that almost never work. There is something about the live experience that's not easily reducible.
You think it's true what he says, what he said on a number of occasions? I just put people in a room and then they start talking and I don't know where they're going to go. I mean, almost sounds a little bit disingenuous.
But it was. I mean, what is Pinter interested in? The enclosed space where two people encounter each other, a collision happens, and life changes. It's incredibly simple. He was a master of observation, so, you know, he would watch how people behaved like a scalpel. But I think that's true, that he let them go where they wanted to go, which is why he said, you know, he never manipulates his characters to make a point that he wouldn't make or get on a soapbox or do something that he wouldn't do. He trusted his characters profoundly. And it's why they have stayed so alive and why I actually think Pinter's plays don't date.
Here's Susan, who writes, we saw The Birthday Party on Sunday. What a great show to leave on. It was beautifully cast. Judith Ivey's Meg was, I like this wording, fascinatingly vapid. I loved it.
succulent, I think, is the word she uses.
Succulent is the word, right? Yeah. Oh, Stanley, don't call me succulent. Here's Jean, who says, I recognize that San Francisco is expensive, but it seemed very anti-local of ACT to close down the Scene Shop and put most of or all of its union stage carpenters out of work. Why couldn't you have rented cheaper elsewhere and kept the workers employed?
Oh, would I have loved to. It's one of the most heartbreaking things to me that that shop closed. We rented the shop. We didn't own it. It was sold out from under us. And in a big real estate speculation, we spent a year combing the city to find a place that we could build our own scenery and that we could bring up to code. And it had to have, you know, a dye vat and welding equipment and everything that we needed. And we could not find a space anywhere in the city. And if anybody's listening here and has wonderful ideas about that, please let us know. We have the best stage crew. I mean, IA has been very important to ACT. The stage crew that runs our Geary shows is incomparable. But the real estate killed us on our Scene Shop. We still do have a costume shop, and for that I'm incredibly grateful. But, you hang on to these things by a thread when you are renting space in San Francisco because we can't compete right now with the commercial real estate market.
Talking again with ACT Artistic Director Carrie Perloff, and let's go to another caller from San Francisco. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is, I was on the board of the Shakespeare Festival in San Francisco, and also I've been a member of ACT for about 35 years when it got started practically. And One thing that bothered me was a Shakespeare production, this recent Shakespeare production. One, they were dressed in street clothes, but the lords and the higher people should have been in suits, because that
Excuse me, Paul, this was Hamlet, right?
Hamlet, yeah. What did I say?
Oh, yes, God. Claudius was absolutely in a suit.
No, but all of the upper class people. Another thing, you have a tendency, not you, but there's a tendency to have too much detail in the background, and it distracts from the play. And I could go on. And also, they read their lines too fast. It was more of a, you know, it just was weak.
You didn't like the production, Paul. That's obvious, and I thank you for calling. I did put out the request for productions loved and hated and everything, but, you know, that's just, like Mark Twain used to say, that's what makes horse races.
That's right.
Yeah, let me thank for the call and go on to another caller. We'll go to you, Christina. You're on the air.
Hi, what a pleasure and what an honor. Thank you so much, Carrie. I was not raised to go to the theater, and I was raised in front of a TV set, and long ago you had The Tempest with David Strathairn, and that kind of roped me in, and little by little, also I didn't have a lot of money at that time, and then I just decided to start going to the theater more because it kept feeding on me. You know, it was the experience kept talking to me. And so now what I do is I try and drag a friend to the theater. And believe me, sometimes it is dragging. Like, you know, a lot of interrogation. Like, what are we going to see?
Tell me
exactly what we're going to see.
Right.
And even if it's something that's kind of out there, later on, I mean, well, first of all, sitting in the theater, it's such a beautiful experience. It's luscious and lovely. And I like the mezzanine, so it's a perfect perch for that experience. And then later on, they start telling me, I've never been here. Why haven't I been here? And so I'd say, tell everybody, take a friend.
Isn't that fantastic?
Do the theater a favor. And I'm going to miss you. And I have friends who used to go to the theater, who I've dragged to the theater, and they were really surprised. They were surprised that you were going to be leaving. So it's an event in the community that people are feeling.
Well, that's really kind of you.
Yeah, and well said,
so
Christina.
Appreciate it.
Let me thank you for the call. Let me go to a comment from Donald, who says, for me, the most memorable ACT production was The Goat or Who's Sylvia. I took an immediate dislike to the female lead, the wife mother. She came across to me as smug and self-satisfied and a cold fish. Of course, her husband fell in love with a goat. I'll never forget seeing her come on stage with Sylvia's carcass. I was stunned and very angry at the character. And speaking of characters, Carol wants to know, well, she says, I saw The Birthday Party. It was one of the three best productions I've ever seen at ACT. Thank you, Ms. Perloff. One question, what's the reason Goldberg's character is Jewish?
What's the reason anyone's Jewish? That's how they're born.
Also is significant, I think, as you said before, that Harold Pinter was Jewish. You did a production of Khalid Hussein's novel, The Thousand Splendid Sons.
Yes.
It's at the Globe? It went to the Globe after?
No, it's going to. Actually, Khalid Hussein's novel, A Thousand Splendid Sons, we adapted. And we did it last February at the Geary, which was thrilling. And now it played Canada, and it's about to play Canada again at the Grand Theatre in London, Ontario. And then we're taking it to the Old Globe in May in San Diego. And then it's coming back to the Geary this summer. So if anybody's listening and didn't have a chance to see it or loves the novel or wants to see it again, we hope you'll come see it. It's a really beautiful story of women in Afghanistan. It's a really important story to see. And then it's going to open Seattle Rep season next fall and go on tour. So there sometimes is life after.
And we featured the novel and the author
on
the forum. It's in our archives. Let me go to another caller in the meantime. And that's you, Barbara. You're on the air.
Thank you for the transition. I back and applaud your promotion of early exposure to the theater.
Mm-hmm.
My first exposure was at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, where I saw a beautiful, splendid Hamlet by William Ball.
Oh, my goodness. How wonderful.
Yes. And this was, I was a young person then. I went on to sell tickets for the Starlight Opera, where you watch it outside.
Right.
In the park there, and Balboa Park. And then when I got to the Bay Area, I was with we were with the Young Conservatory.
Really?
Yes, yes.
How wonderful.
And I had a family member who was a participant in that. The play that sticks with me, and I don't know exactly why, I know he was a stinker to work with as a playwright, Albee's Tiny Alice. That
Well,
was one of the first productions.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't like Bill Ball because Bill Ball tried to rewrite the play. So playwrights don't like that, you know. he, I think, eventually got over it, you know, and gave us the rights. But I love what you're saying and about arts education. And I would just say, you know, one of the people that has been most seminal at ACT in my 25 years is Elizabeth Broderson, who runs our education and community programs. She's a heroine. She ran our publication staff for many years. She's just dogged in her pursuit of opening up this art form to underserved people. And it's been incredibly moving to see that program grow and people being introduced to this work and falling in love with it against all odds.
Well, we've come to the end of this hour, and I just want to congratulate you on an amazing career and warm wishes for this life beyond your life now as artistic director. I know more things will come from you. We look forward to them, and we've been very fortunate to have you here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
I have been so lucky to have this job, so thank you for having me.
Carrie Perloff, again, is with us this hour, and her play that she's directed is The Birthday Party, running through the 4th of February at the American Conservatory Theater. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program, and stay tuned with us on KQED Radio. And for all of us here, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.